Their daughters. Paracetamol legends I know for rising fevers as pain relievers. Of my people, father's father's mother's mother, dark lush hair caressing her ankles, sometimes sweeping earth, deep honey skin, amber eyes. Not beauty alone, they say. She married a man who murdered 13 men, and one lonely summer afternoon, her rice-white teeth tore through layers of khaki and golden-white skin to spill the bloodied guts of a British soldier who tried to colonize her. Of my land, uniform blue open skies, mad artist palettes of green lands and lily-filled lakes that mirror all. Not peace and tranquil alone, he shudders. A young wife near my father's home, with a drunken husband who never changed. She bore his daily beatings until on one stormy night, in fury, she killed him by stomping his seed bags. We, the daughters of their soil, we mostly write.
You've just heard the voice of Meena Kandasamy reading her poem, Their Daughters, from her book, Touch. Meena is a young poet activist from Tamil Nadu, India's southeasternmost state. When we spoke in the capital city of Chennai, words bubbled out of her, impassioned and unbridled. Her poetry bears this same kind of energy. Meena wields language to confront deep-rooted struggles in Indian society, such as sexual violence and caste, particularly the oppression of Dalits, India's lowest caste, traditionally known as untouchable. For Meena, poetry is not an internal activity, existing for the sake of abstraction. She says poetry, unlike inaccessible academic writing or overly polished human rights speak, is the most direct and powerful route to articulating burning issues as well as the struggle for change.
I think poetry works easier because it's quite universal, and also unlike a story where even if you really have a strong political message, it could just get lost, let's say, within the story. The poetry can be very standalone and very powerful. And also I think with poetry, it's been used for pushing a certain politics, or this politics of dissent, for instance, for many people. And I do strongly identify with poets in India and abroad who are writing poetry that is related to the people, poetry that chronicles their struggles. You have someone like Varavara Rao, for instance, and his poems really speak about the people's struggles. So a lot of Dalit poetry speaks about the people's struggles, or the early African American poetry, black poetry. So I do identify, and I think I'm hugely influenced by the voice of dissent there. And I think you cannot do it this strongly in fiction. Of course, fiction is more like a chronicle, but can fiction be a statement? Can it actually challenge, and can it be as sharp and hard-hitting as poetry? I don't believe it can be. So when, and I also especially tend to think of the poet as the enemy of the state, or a poet as somebody who actually has to speak up for the people. So I take poetry quite seriously. You must have heard of what Adrian Mitchell once said about poetry. A lot of people don't care about a lot of poetry because a lot of poetry doesn't care about a lot of people. So what I tend to think is that if poetry exists for the sake of abstraction, or for the sake of, let's say, a rhythm count or a meter, then of course poetry has the liberty to exist for that reason alone. But I'm sure that poetry can be very direct, and poetry can be very powerful, and poetry can be very subversive. And in societies where, you know, your freedom of expression is under a lot of restriction, I believe that poetry has this instant appeal and can actually reach out to people who are similarly, I think, either oppressed or similarly do subscribe to an idea of revolution. Because, for instance, I know that some of my poems were read by students at FLU when they were protesting. And I think when your poetry is used in protest just like that, you know, not in the abstract, but, you know, as a means of protest, then I think it's really very powerful. And you see that happening. So it's not something that's lost. It's not something like something that people have to imagine or envision. It's something that's in the here and in the now.
Do you think, as George Orwell said, that all writing is political?
Well, the act of all writing is political, and the act of not writing at some points is also very political, because, for instance, what's happening in India, like the Operation Green Hunt, the huge silence of a lot of writers about it, they would rather write about what they had for breakfast, you know, than write about what's happening to, you know, the Adivasi people who were caught in the crossfire, or the huge silence that I witnessed in the Indian media during the genocide of the Tamils in Sri Lanka. For instance, I think all of these are instances that clearly show that all writing, like all silence, is very political.
You started to talk about how, though Tamil is your mother tongue, you do write in English. Is writing in English a conscious choice? Is not writing in Tamil a conscious choice?
Well, writing in Tamil was, I never learned that language in a very schoolgirl fashion. Like, I didn't learn it at school because of, I think, a very skewed language policy. I studied in a school that was subsidized by the central government, so I learned only Hindi, which nobody speaks. I mean, the only opportunity I get to speak Hindi is when I really travel many thousands of kilometers away from my home. So when nobody speaks the language around you, then I'm not going to be writing in Hindi at all, because it's a very textbook knowledge. And I'm not going to be writing in Tamil, because my knowledge of Tamil is very personal and colloquial, and what I learned from, you know, hearing my parents or hearing those around me, and of course reading the text by myself. So the only choice for me was to write in something, and the only something that I thought I could express myself in is English. Even though my writing in English is an accident of circumstance, I believe that with English, though, the huge power is that much as we can problematize the language and its colonial history, we have to understand that at present it's a language that has a huge, enormous global reach. And sometimes, you know, if you're screaming in your bedroom, it doesn't help. You just have to sometimes come out on the road and start screaming there in order to get attention. If, you know, if there's violence going on, if there's abuse going on. So I think that kind of English, it allows me to scream from the streets.
While Hindi and English are India's official languages, the country is also home to 22 official regional languages and hundreds of dialects. However, in 1965, attempts were made to make Hindi the sole official language of the Republic. This sparked enormous protests in the Tamil-speaking South. Eventually, the government of India guaranteed that a policy of bilingualism, Hindi and English, would endure. But linguistic identity in India remains highly controversial.
15 years after the constitution was adopted in 65, there were attempts, serious attempts, to impose Hindi and make it the sole official language. And I think here is where I really go back to my Tamil roots. I feel very proud because more than 65 people immolated themselves protesting it. And I think there were thousands of people who had attempted immolations, people who were, you know, jailed. The army was called in to control the situation in Tamil Nadu. This was in 1965. And I think, I'm not even sure about the numbers, because I'm very sure there were, you know, hundreds of deaths. These were young people on the streets. They knew the future was being snatched away, the culture was being snatched away, that some of the culture was being imposed on them, some of the language was being imposed on them. And if people won, it's because of the struggle. If Hindi is not the sole official language, if you know, there is this place for English as a common language or a linked language, I think it's a very conscious choice that the people decided to fight against it.
Many have argued that the coexistence of India's numerous ethnic groups, languages, and regional identities is an astonishing accomplishment and something to be celebrated. But Meena says that in a country rife with inequality, this idea of unity rings false.
Technically, and you have to give this to Charu Mazumdar, who basically was channeling Lenin when he said that India is nothing but a prison house of nationalities. And I really second that. I think we are a prison house of nationalities, because there are like these thousands of nationalities, all which are forced together. This is not a natural nation, which are forced together by the British, maybe for administrative reasons. But after independence, all of these nationalities are together. And, you know, this idea of India itself is an oppressive idea, because how do you define India? I think the only true evidence or the true realization of what's going to be India is going to come when people actually begin the struggle, because of the people's struggle. I think the idea of India is enshrined in the people's struggles. People are fighting against oppression. People are fighting everywhere against the same repressive government against the, you know, the use of police force or army force, people who are, you know, fighting against the system, this brings together, this makes us an India, not this idea of the fact that, okay, yes, we have a constitution, not the idea that, you know, okay, we, because we are in this, you know, this between these rocks, we decide to call ourselves India. So I think we are many nationalities, and the only way in which we are ever going to forge this unitary subcontinental identity or this identity of India is going to be through our struggles.
No, interesting. I mean, we've spoken to other writers who've talked about how this sort of plural temper is a feature of Indian culture, this idea of coexistence and, you know, many religions, languages, cultures. This diversity is what sort of forges the idea of India.
I wouldn't say it's the diversity. I'm not denying the diversity, but I think that to believe that we are a nation at present, we are not a nation because, you know, you discover 3,000 graves of young men in Kashmir, and we all go on with our daily life like nothing happened. You have 48 deaths of, you know, children in starvation in Madhya Pradesh, and I don't think people here talk about it. They don't feel guilty eating the next meal. So, or, you know, the people from the Northeast were chased. We're literally chased out of every city a few months back, I think in August, because of rumors. And how does that happen? Why do we not accept the minorities? Why don't we? Because we really look at each other as strangers. We really, it's not like we really are like one big happy family. I mean, if somebody is saying that, they're deluding themselves. But because of the struggles against, let's say, a common center, the struggles for our own identities, we will understand them. Because when people are oppressed, they speak a similar language. When I'm an oppressed Tamil woman, I can understand the language of a Palestinian. I can understand the language of somebody who is angry, you know, about what's happening in Gaza. Or because I'm because of where I come from, this can forge identities. This can bring about the real India. Because otherwise, to believe that there is an India, I think this lovely idea of an India, it exists for the ruling classes. It exists for the very elite. It exists for those who run businesses, people who are in politics. It exists for media personalities and maybe cricket stars. But for the others, I don't think. I think we are navigating and negotiating something much more complex than that. So I don't think, you know, we can voice this idea of a nation and expect people to behave like a nation, because they are behaving. I mean, you cannot, I mean, this is what Ambedkar said, you cannot envision a nation in a country that's, you know, divided into thousands of castes, because the caste becomes the primary identity. And that's why when you call for caste annihilation, when you call for things like this, you know, people, a lot of people would say, you know, when you talk about annihilating caste, you're you know, showing India's ugly side. No, I'm somebody who loves India. I'm somebody who loves India and has more hopes for India than any of the so-called nationalists would have. That's why I say, let caste go. Let's finally get a feeling of what it means to be Indian. And in fighting against, let's say, a system like caste, we will find ourselves. We will find our voice. And I don't think any people anywhere in the world were united without having to have fight for something. You really have to stand up against something in order to come closer.
India's reservation system is a form of affirmative action for groups on the lower levels of the caste system that have been historically and institutionally oppressed and excluded from mainstream opportunities. Reservations exist primarily in universities, government jobs, and other public institutions, often in the form of quotas reserved for specific groups. The system is a hotly contested issue. Some argue it further entrenches caste identities instead of doing away with caste labels completely. Others say it's a feeble attempt to rectify the horrors of the caste system, and others deem it necessary for ensuring some level of equal opportunity.
See, to believe that a system like caste can be eradicated through something which is like, you know, basically giving a peanut to a dog, that's what your quota system is. That's what reservation is. Because caste is a kind of it's a kind of structural, intellectual, cultural, and economic genocide on a very slow scale. It tells some people not to have dreams. It tells some people they're really restricted. It tells some people not to step out of their homes. It puts women in their place. It's a system by which, I mean, reservation is not any kind of elevation to caste. It's like, you know, it's like I cannot even find the actual metaphor to talk about the gruesome, you know, the crime of what caste exactly is, and what the cruel of its cruelty and its violence on a daily basis. And for people to actually posit reservation as something that's going to heal caste, and especially I think this new trend of the ruling classes, the ruling caste and the oppressive caste, to actually say that, you know, they have lost everything, they are outraged that the quotas have come. They all have a cousin who didn't get into college because there were quotas or reservation, that, you know, merit has been compromised. I think that's bullshit. My mother, actually, she works in an IIT, and she was one of the first people to actually begin fighting for the system. She is a women mathematician, she's a scientist. She comes from the backward classes. She was, I mean, I think for a long, she is, I think, possibly the only backward class woman mathematician belonging to the backward caste in IIT. And I know that even as it is difficult, very difficult for women in the sciences, it becomes much more difficult if you add a level of challenge to it. You belong to a backward caste. There is no godfather looking for you. There is no cultural capital. You don't know people in the right places. And then, because, you know, the caste system is not something that basically only groups you, but it also tells you you're inferior, you're intellectually inferior, then you're naturally, you're not acknowledged for your contributions, you're not acknowledged for your merit. And what's the reservation policy? Reservation policy is something that says if somebody is good enough, you fill these many number of seats. But this, I think this kind of, you know, believing that reservation is the solution, I think we have to start looking outside reservation, even as we continue the reservation policy. Because this reservation, they're not giving it in any economic form. If they're having, you know, auctions, if they're having tenders, they're not giving, you know, equal reservation there. Where money, huge money is involved, there's no reservation.
You've said that if the reservation system did not exist, India would have experienced its first real revolution. Now, to what extent does this system act as a valve, in some respect, maintain a status quo?
No, I don't think reservation maintains a status quo per se. It just makes you a little, because it does give upward mobility to certain people who are then empowered to talk and who may choose or not choose to talk on behalf of their caste or their caste position. You know, it would be easy to assimilate, it would be easy to maintain your silence. Once you go into this bourgeois educational system, then you become a puppet in its hands. It's like what Badiou says, for the petty bourgeois, you think that the education system is the only thing that's going to empower you. It's going to find you a place in the ruling classes. It's going to, you know, and then you become a kind of machinery. You become something that's going to serve all these feudal interests, that's going to serve these imperialist interests, that's going to serve these bourgeois interests. And so, who are you? What's your place in the world? Are you willing to go against the system? Is your education allowing you to speak out, or does it make you, you know, one more mission? And this, I think, reservation actually opened the doors to education, but that education was not an education of, you know, like the kind of an education of transgression, an education of critical pedagogy, an education of, you know, militancy, and it's an education of conformism. And this education, I always have troubles with.
In your translation work, what kinds of voices are you trying to bring out? And how is translation a part of your larger project?
Yeah, I think I started translating by doing the speeches and writings of a Dalit leader from Tamil Nadu, which I thought was important because he was raising a lot of questions that were relevant to the rest of India, talking about religion and oppression and nationalism, which also relate to people in other parts of the world. So I thought, this is something that I should be reading in English. And when I felt that, I thought, okay, let others who read English not be deprived of it. But I also think that at some point, the whole idea of translations is really important. And I should always remain a translator too, because there's a lot of gatekeeping. There's a lot of gatekeeping because for some reasons the people who get to decide what's getting translated, they would like texts that are really very soft and not something that challenges the status quo. They would like, you know, literature of suffering. And I think they like literatures of suffering. They like literatures of, you know, deep personal pain, because then reading becomes an act of compassion. You feel good about yourself because you're like, oh, she's so sad and I feel so bad for her. You know, I just wish I could hold her. Whereas not reading as an act of rebellion, reading as an act of struggle for justice. So therefore, I think I want to be a translator because I want to work into these spaces where there is otherwise silence.
Your writing with poetry is perhaps a personal and direct manner of self-realization and of checking in with this psychological notion that caste is a barrier to aspiration. Do you think there is any other medium or indeed activism that can promote this sense of realization and break down this barrier of psychology?
Yes, I think a lot of Dalit movements actually, and this is initially the first step, is that they reinforce a lot of pride until you say with pride that you are a Dalit. And I think it's very essential for people to feel that pride. And a lot of history, for instance, is that, okay, we were the original inhabitants of the land, and sometimes it's like we were the original rulers of the land. And do you go cross-checking this history? No. At some point, you realize that this history of, you know, reaffirmation, this history of declaring yourself to be powerful is very essential in order to be on an equal footing and on an equal standing ground. So I believe that the Dalit movement, as they exist in India, are taking pride in who they are. And that's why I say, when you talk about this history of oppression, you also have to talk about this history of, you know, standing up against resistance. Because if you've been oppressed for 5,000 years, well, you have also been fighting against oppression for 5,000 years. And that fighting should make you a very proud person.
Does annihilating caste involve a political movement or political action, or is it something that needs to come from within?
It has to be a movement, and I think, I'm not sure what forms it takes, but it has to be a movement. It is at every point in everybody's life, it is a moment of self-realization that, you know, that this shit doesn't matter, that you have to face up to it. But I also think that nothing can be done unless there is concerted political action, there is concerted real action, you know, in which people are united, in which people struggle. So to believe that it can, you know, only be nice, no, I don't think it can change things. Because there are many nice people on the planet, and the fact that they're not coming together is one reason why we're really suffering. There are many good people who would never hurt a fly, who possibly only use, you know, recycled material, who, you know, don't waste water in the shower, who really put the lights out when it's not needed. But all these good people, these individual acts of salvation, will not take us anywhere. We have to organize at some point.
Meena reads her poem Muligatani Dreams from her book Touch.
Anaconda, candy, cash, katamaran, cherut, kuli, corundum curry, ginger, mango, muligatani, pachali, papadam rice, tatti, teak, vetiver. I dream of an English full of the words of my language, an English in small letters, an English that shall tire a white man's tongue, an English where small children practice with smooth round pebbles in their mouth to spell the right ra, an English where a pregnant woman is simply stomach child lady. An English where the magic of black eyes and brown bodies replaces the glamour of eyes in dishwater blue shades and the airbrush romance of pink-white cherry blossom skins. An English where love means only the strange frenzy between a man and his beloved, not between him and his car. An English without the privacy of its many rooms. An English with suffixes for respect. An English with more than 36 words to call the sea. An English that doesn't belittle brown or black men or women. An English of tasting with five fingers, an English of talking love with eyes alone, and a dream of an English where men of that spiky, crunchy tongue buy flower garlands of jasmine to take home to their coy wives for the silent demand of a night of wordless, whispered love.
This show was produced by Henry Peck and Meera Sharma. This has been Almira Radio. Thank you for listening.